National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Catholic Church's liturgical year draws to a close this weekend with the Feast of Christ the King. Then the season of Advent begins. We take a quick look at the Register's Advent and Christmas guides to help us prepare for the season. Then we turn to the hopes of ceasefire in Lebanon. With our guest Alberto Fernandez, we get a glimpse of how the conflict has affected Christians there. And finally, we celebrate an anniversary. It's been 60 years since the Second Vatican Council gave us Lumen Gentium, a document meant to bring the light of Christ to the nations. Opus Dei priest Father Joseph Thomas shares his insights into what this means for us today. I'm Jeanette DiMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host, and EWTN News' vice president and editorial director. And before we turn to the topics, the news topics of today's show, we want to draw some attention to the Register's devotional content, as well as some practical guides for the approaching season of Advent. To do that, we've invited Amy Smith, Register Features Editor, to join us. Hi, Amy.
Hello. Great to be here.
So it's a very busy time of year, and of course, during this time, as a church, we are invited to deepen our spiritual lives to prepare for Christ's coming. So, Amy, tell us what the Register offers to help us do that.
Sure. We have so much great content. Starting off with our Thanksgiving issue, our longtime Sunday Guide writer, Monsignor Charles Pope, asks our readers, is Christ really your King? Ahead of Sunday's solemnity. So he invites our readers to ask themselves, do we believe that Jesus is King? Does he truly have authority over our lives? And how? And to discern how we need to change how we're living and praying, perhaps. This also relates to the Christ the King novena that is underway with the U.S. bishops through November 23rd. And all of that content will be online at ncregister.com. But looking ahead to Advent, we have practical guides about how to live the season well within your family so we can prepare our hearts to welcome Jesus at Christmas time. So in our December 1st issue, we have 7 ways to live Advent as a Catholic family from longtime writer Katie Warner. Mm-hmm. So she recommends everything from the Jesse tree tradition, you know, walking through the ancestral line of Jesus, as well as the Advent wreath. And there's great resources for all of those at EWTN Religious Catalog, of course.
Yes. And she also... Speaking of the catalog, I just want to jump to one of the unique things that the Register does, and it gets so much attention. We know from online just how many people click on these articles. But what about the guides? Like, we have not only spiritual stuff, but we have practical content too. So these are the gift guides. Can you give us a little, I guess, verbal glimpse of what's included in those gift guides, stuff from the Religious Catalog and other things? What are some of the hot items you think we're promoting there?
Of course. We have really great ideas for Advent feast days, like celebrating St. Nicholas Day or St. Lucy Day. So about half of our offerings come directly from Religious Catalog, which is really great. And we even have sections such as Inspired by Mother Angelica, which is a big draw, I think. But we have categories for priests, for family, for children. We even include travel and experiences such as pilgrimages and prayer bouquets.
Right.
So we kind of cover everything, which is really great.
Awesome. So, Amy, I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to invite our listeners, as you have, to go to ncregister.com and look at these gift guides. Look at also the spiritual guides that will help us prepare in every way for the upcoming season. The November 3rd print edition and the December 1st print editions also have this content. So thanks for joining us. We're going to turn now to the topics of this show. Lebanon and Hezbollah have agreed to a U.S.-proposed ceasefire with Israel, and now all eyes are on Israel as the U.S. tries to negotiate the close of that deal. This conflict has really brought about a humanitarian crisis in Gaza and in Lebanon. It's been really really tragic. To help us understand this and the gravity of this conflict, especially on Christians in Lebanon, we have Alberto Fernandez, a former U.S. diplomat and contributor to EWTN News as the Middle East and North Africa editor. We're so grateful to have you, Alberto. And as I mentioned, this is really a humanitarian crisis, so we want to focus on that. But first off, what do you expect of this current, negotiations with Israel? All eyes are on Israel right now. What should we expect?
Well, thank you for having me on. We're close, but the problem is that the 95% of a potential agreement has been for a while pretty obvious. It's last few percentages, and it's not exactly true that Hezbollah has accepted it. Mm-hmm. Both Israel and Hezbollah have kind of accepted it, but both of them are maneuvering about the last few percentages, which is basically about who has the right to do what after a ceasefire. For Israel, obviously, it's a right of response, right for it to hit suspicious targets or terrorist targets that it sees in South Lebanon. For Hezbollah, it is to violate a UN Security Council resolution 1701, which has been in effect for 18 years, which says Hezbollah shouldn't be in South Lebanon. What Hezbollah did after 2006 is they infiltrated the South, they built rocket bases, they built underground bunkers and weapons caches and all of that stuff, something which they weren't able to do. So Hezbollah wants to do that again. Israel wants to prevent them from doing that again.
Yeah, Alberto, the reality for the people who are in Lebanon facing the crisis now with Hezbollah and Israel. Can you talk about the toll that that's taking, but also how old this conflict is?
Well, the toll is tremendous. You have to remember that Lebanon was already in a deep economic crisis with the currency collapse and the collapse of the banking system before this war started. And of course, Hezbollah brazenly boasted on October 8, 2023, that it was joining Hamas's war against Israel. So it kind of dragged Lebanon, which is already battered and beaten down, it dragged Lebanon into this war, which has been, really difficult for the Lebanese people. Basically, a quarter of the Lebanese people right now are displaced, are internally displaced, or have become refugees. Some of them have actually fled into Syria, which is, not a very good place in and of itself. On paper, of course, the war has been in place since 1948. Now, there was a ceasefire agreement in 1949, and for about 20 years, there was peace. There was not a peace agreement, but there was calm on the border between Israel and Lebanon. That began to change in the late 1960s. First with the Palestinians and then with other groups. But basically what you had is Lebanon became a battlefield for other actors. First for the PLO, then for the Assad regime of Syria, and most recently over the last, say, 20 years, Hezbollah and Hezbollah's patron and master, Iran. There was a way of Iran projecting power directly against Israel.
Yeah, you recently penned for the Register a commentary. A Christian border town in Lebanon is in the crosshairs again, which can be found at ncregister.com. It's also going to be in our December 1st print edition. Let's look at that, about the Christians who are in the crossfire in the middle of this. They seem to be unable to escape this cycle.
That's true. And of course, in that sense, they mirror the reality of most Lebanese Muslim, Christian, or Druze, who basically want to live their lives. They want to be left alone. They want to deal with their families, think about their future, what most people in the world want. And yet their country has been dragged into being a battlefield for over 50 years. So the Christians of Ramesh, it's a large village, small town, very close to the Israeli border. It's one of several Christian villages, mostly overwhelmingly Maronite Catholic, in a sea of Shia villages. And of course, Hezbollah concentrates on firing rockets from the Shia villages, building bunkers, building bases. The Christians of Ramesh have prevented, physically prevented Hezbollah from firing rockets against Israel from their town. It's not because they love Israel. It's because they love themselves. They love their own town, and they want their own town to be intact and at peace and not be dragged into anybody else's war.
It's really amazing, the witness of these people and what they've been able to prevent in their town. Your article really chronicles it well, and it makes you really sympathize with the plight that they've experienced for so long. But you also mentioned, Alberto, that this isn't that isn't a unique reality for many Christians. This is experienced elsewhere, where Christians are end up being in the crossfires of two different peoples, and they are simply trying to live their lives. Where else have we seen this?
Well, unfortunately, we see that in many places. Of course, in the Holy Land, we see that, where Christians are a small minority and they are wary and careful about getting in the crossfire of either Israel or the Palestinian militant groups or terrorist groups. You know, Christians have very little political power in the Middle East. The only place that statistically or historically they had political power, of course, was Lebanon. But everywhere else, they're caught between various fires and various contending entities, whether regimes, terrorist groups, revolutionaries. There's part, for example, of southern Turkey, which was until the 1980s overwhelmingly Christian. And they're forced out because of an insurgency that had nothing to do with them. It was between the Turkish government, the Turkish military, and Kurdish militants. They were caught in the middle, and eventually they fled. And most of them, you know, went to Western Europe. And unfortunately, this region, Tur Abdin in southern Turkey, which was a heartland of Syriac Christianity, has been mostly depopulated. So we see that in other places, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Syria, in Iraq, and in the Holy Land.
Right. And, you know, we're so grateful at EWTN News to have your contribution as editor of the Middle East and North Africa region. And we're grateful for that, because it is so important that we understand the impact of these world events on Christians and on other minorities like the Christians in these areas. And so just a word of gratitude. Thank you for what you're doing together with us at EWTN to news to spread this information and report the news.
Thank you very much, and God bless you and your important work.
I'm going to repeat again the title of his article so you can find it at ncregister.com. It's "A Christian Border Town in Lebanon is in the Crosshairs Again," and that is written by Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, and it can be found in the December 1st print edition. You've been listening to Register Radio. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Father Joseph Thomas as we delve into how the Church reflects Christ, the light to all nations, as we explore the 60th anniversary of the Vatican II document, Lumen Gentium. Stay tuned. You're listening to Register Radio on EWTN.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. And as I mentioned, we're celebrating an anniversary, the 60th anniversary of Lumen Gentium, a dogmatic constitution of the Second Vatican Council. And for those of us who don't know enough about that particular teaching of the Second Vatican Council, we have a guest today who's going to help unpack it for us. That's Opus Dei Father Joseph Thomas. He is the chaplain of Mercer House in Princeton, New Jersey. He's the author of several books from Scepter Publishing, the most recent of which is The Theology of Divine Grace. He also publishes at ncregister.com, and that's what we're going to focus on right now. He's written a series of columns on Lumen Gentium over the past year. It started all the way in January that he started writing on this. And today, November 21st, is when we're recording this show, and this is the actual anniversary of the document. So, Father Joseph, it's a wonderful day to have you on.
Yeah, thank you, Jeanette. Yeah, I'm glad it worked out to be able to talk on this key day in, what I would say, key day in church history.
Exactly. It really is. And so, I mean, one thing I just have to ask, we've already, the Register has already published 7 columns starting last January. We're still kind of going chapter by chapter, so I'm sure we've probably got a few more to look at. But that's a lot of ink on one document. So my first question is, why is Lumen Gentium so important that we would spend that much time writing about it and reading about it?
I think it comes down to a key question, which the Vatican II Council Fathers were asking, and which really has a lot to do with our own lives today as Catholics, which is simply, what is the Church? Mm. I mean, it might sound like a simple question, but if we were to think about it, not so easy to answer. I might say, well, you know, the Church is the priests or the Pope or this or that experience I've had. But, you know, it's not easy to actually articulate what is the Church. And basically, in a nutshell, Lumen Gentium is an attempt by the Catholic Church in an ecumenical council to answer, in the circumstances of the modern world, just what is the Church? And I think that is something that very much affects our daily life today. So I do think it's something which is important for us Catholics to reflect on. Obviously, I'm hoping that the listeners and readers will read the documents, but it can be helpful to have a little bit of an explanation, some guides to help people in their reading and study of the Church documents.
Much has been made in the post-conciliar era, and especially now, in light of synodality, which I'd love to come back to ask you about more specifically, but the notion or the image of the people of God and the place of lay people in the life of the Church. How important or innovative was Lumen Gentium in articulating that, and how has that been applied in the decades, the 60-odd years since the Council?
First of all, I'd like to say that, you know, Lumen Gentium uses a number of different images for the Church, and of course we're not going to have time to talk about all of them, but certainly yeah. People of God was a very important one. It's actually not the kind of the first key image that the Lumen Gentium uses.
Mm-hmm.
Lumen Gentium kind of talks about the mystical body of Christ, which is a very important idea that had developed in the 20th century, particularly in the teaching of Pius XII. But the Council Fathers realized that people of God was particularly valuable for expressing the fact that the Church is present in history, and also for expressing the equality of all of the people of God. So where, for example, if you're in a body, like in the mystical body, there's a head, there's members, but there's not so much the sense that everybody's equal. I mean, it's hard to see how, like, I don't know, the hand or whatever is exactly the same as the head. There's a kind of a hierarchy within the body, whereas in the people, there's a deep sense of equality, which, you know, is present in the Old Testament people of God, but especially, you know, particularly in the New Testament, there's this sense, as St. Paul says, that everyone who is part of his people, united in Christ, forms one single body, one single people, in which everybody's equal. There's no slave or free, male or female, which of course doesn't take away from the fact that there are distinctive roles in the Church. That's another topic. And also, you also asked about the laity, and certainly the emphasis on people of God was very helpful for giving that particular role to the laity. I mean, there's a whole important history about this, that, you know, but basically, you know, in the 20th century, the Church was going through a lot of challenging times, and they're claiming the gospel in contemporary circumstances, and just by necessity, the Church realized that we need the laity to play more of a role in the evangelizing mission of the Church. And by giving attention to people of God, the Council wanted to express the way in which the laity are equally members of the Church along with everybody else. And one specific way that happened was that after Chapter 1, which focused on the mystery of the Church, originally the Council was going to talk about the bishops and the hierarchy, which is now Chapter 3. But the Council Fathers realized, well, no, first, before talking about the bishops and the hierarchy, we need to first talk about the people of God. Now, everybody is equal, and then move on to the more specific roles.
It's really unique. Your columns break down some of that insight into not simply what the document says, what Lumen Gentium says, just the teaching that we need to receive into our hearts and into our lives, but how it came to be. And you just explained that, you know, that it wasn't originally intended to be this way, but they felt it should be structured this way because it revealed, you know, it emphasizes something very important. And so your columns really do that. They help to illuminate what went into this teaching. And that brings me to something I think that it is important. When I think of Lumen Gentium, I think of the universal call to holiness. And one of your columns really emphasizes this as something historic that was in Lumen Gentium. So why was that universal call to holiness that was articulated in Lumen Gentium so historic, so important?
First of all, I would just say that this is the first time in a solemn document of the Church that the Church has embraced this teaching. At the same time, I think we should say it's not really a new teaching. I mean, the idea that we're all called to holiness is present in the Gospel. It's present in the life of the early Church. But over the centuries, let's face it, as the Church became more integrated into society, as different ministries and characters in the Church developed, there were certain emphases, and, you know, through a complex set of circumstances, there was very much the tendency to lose sight of the fact that everybody is called to holiness. But in coming back to the mystery of the Church in Lumen Gentium, really the Church wanted to come back to this truth that the Church is holy. So when we say that we're called to holiness, I think it's important to understand it's not just some kind of invitation, but it's an invitation which comes from the very reality of what the Church is. I mean, the Church is holy. This is an important idea behind Lumen Gentium. That, of course, doesn't mean that there's not sinners in the Church and scandals in the Church, but beyond all of that, the Church is this special place of God's dwelling with man. And so the laity are called to holiness just by the very reality of belonging to the Church, which is holy. And so I would just draw also attention to the way that that call really kind of draws from this kind of central theme of what the Church is.
I really want to also emphasize, because I'm not sure if I said it yet, but Lumen Gentium means in English light of the nations, or light of the peoples, right? And so I think that emphasizing that call to holiness and being a light to the peoples is really important. Matthew, I think you had a final question here.
Yeah, there was a discussion I know during the Council about how to approach the discussion on the Blessed Mother. And I know that the proposal was made for a separate document, but at the end they chose to include her in Chapter 8 of Lumen Gentium. Can you talk about the place of the Blessed Mother and what the Council was trying to tell the Church and the world about her?
Absolutely. This is a very intensely discussed question and perhaps not always well understood even today. The Church wanted to present the importance of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the mystery of Christ and the mystery of Church with reference to Scripture. The Church wanted to sort of be faithful to the whole rich tradition in the Catholic Church, but the Church also was concerned that, you know, certain ways of expressing our Catholic devotion might be misunderstood by Protestants and might sort of give the impression that somehow we give attention to Mary at the expense of Christ. So the Church was very careful in the Council in the way it expressed that devotion to Our Lady. For example, the Church in Lumen Gentium Chapter 8 decides not to use the word Mother of the Church. This is the result of a very long debate. Didn't mean that the Church didn't realize it, but the Church realized that maybe this phrase could be a little bit confusing to Protestants. And actually, on the same day, November 21st, in which the Lumen Gentium is approved, Pope Paul VI, taking the request of many Council Fathers, declares Mary to be Mother of the Church. But the Council very much wanted to emphasize that Mary's role, while very essential within the Church, doesn't take away from Christ, but rather shows the centrality of Christ.
So we have 1 minute left, and I think it's very fitting. I'm probably risking saying too much, but it's fitting in November that this document the month that the church focuses on the last things, heaven, hell, judgment, the souls in purgatory, and saints in heaven. This document is actually emphasizing that as well in one of its chapters, these last realities. And so I'm going to just plug that our listeners go to ncregister.com, and in the search bar, they search your name, Father, because there they'll find these many, seven articles, and there will be more written about Lumen Gentium. And one of those is on the last things, and something that we should really pay attention to right now, the month of November, as we're getting ready to celebrate Christ the King this Sunday, just thinking about what is to come for us in the ultimate realities. And so I'd like to invite you to go to ncregister.com and search Father Joseph Thomas. And when you do, you'll see this list of articles on Lumen Gentium as we, as the Register, has celebrated this 60th anniversary. And Father Joseph, we are just delighted to have you helping us understand this important teaching.
Thank you, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak about this important topic, and I hope listeners find it interesting.
I'm also going to point to November 17th issue of the Register that also has this topic as The Mystery of the Church, Lumen Gentium 60 Years Later, a commentary by Father Joseph Thomas. You've been listening to Register Radio on EWTN. You can go to ncregister.com to find the National Catholic Register's content, news, analysis, and commentary. Thank you for joining us. And until next week, on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, and myself, Jeanette DeMello, I pray that God bless you.